Hello, everybody. Sorry, I'm a little late. I have five botanists staying at my house this week. My dad's having a big conference, and so my house is full of foreign guests, and I had to go pick some of them up from the train station. But here I am, and we're all here. We got 3 minutes. I see Trevor's here, which is very exciting. Spent the afternoon reading mail and answering phone calls. Gallery. All right, Chuck, how many are we expecting tonight? I don't want to get people mad at us like they always do about starting late. So I want to start on time, I guess. That seem reasonable, Chuck? You really can't please everyone. Trevor, remind us where you're from. What state are you in?
I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Got it. So you're an hour later than us. It's 8 for you.
Yep, it's 8 p.m. here. That's right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to us and staying kind of late. Oh, I got to get my book. I mean, my Kindle in the copy of a book. Oh, shoot. I wrote up some little words about you, and now I don't know where they are. So give me a quick second to go find them.
We have 75 signed up for tonight.
Okay. And what are we at right now?
16.
16. Okay. That is not very many out of 75.
It is climbing though. We're up to 18 now.
Excellent. Better than before. Okay. I don't know where I put it. East Coast representing. Very nice. All right, what do you think? It's 7 o'clock. Can we like split the difference and wait till 7:03 without making anybody yell at me?
Don't know.
We're gonna give it a try. Let's see. Lana, I've never seen you on the call before. You wanna tell us something about yourself real quick, like? Oh, hang on, that's not working.
We can't hear you, Linnell. I know Linnell. I sh Can you try now?
She doesn't sh I mean, I show her as not being muted, so this must be a problem with her computer, I guess.
Yeah, we can't hear you. Linnell, I met at NARSOL. Her son was in civil commitment in Texas. But I'm not sure.
Yeah, something must be wrong with her computer or her microphone.
I think she might be typing in the chat, maybe. I'm not sure.
Justin says he's okay with grace periods. All right, Justin, tell us a little bit about yourself because you're the next one on the top of my chart. Introduce yourself, Justin.
Hi, I'm Justin. Hailing from Virginia. So howdy, neighbor Trevor. And just so glad to be here.
How long have you been involved with this whole ridiculous nonsense?
With this group for about 2 months now.
Okay, and how long have you been dealing with the chaos that is the registry?
For almost a year now.
So you're new, still new.
Correct.
All right, how about Jean? Want to tell us a little bit about yourself, real quick, like?
Sure. I'm in Baltimore, and my boyfriend is in Texarkana.
That's where my partner served.
Yes, lovely place. Impossible to get to. So I haven't seen him for 2 years because it's just too expensive and too difficult to get there. He wasn't supposed to go there. He was supposed to go to Sigaville, which is a little more convenient, but the BOP does whatever it wants.
Kenneth Ackerman. How do I know that name? Hi, Ken. You want to introduce yourself real quick?
Sure.
Oops.
Ken Ackerman from Nebraskans Unafraid. We have Wednesday night dinners. We work with trying to change things on legislation. We actually keep people in our basement apartment that get out of prison, and very active. And
Nice.
the newest thing we're trying for Nebraskans Unafraid is to get involved with understanding victims. We had a guest speaker at our Fearless meeting on Alternative to Violence Project. And I remember when I was in prison meeting someone who said they gave him the ability to understand and empathize with the people he was robbing. And I thought, what an interesting concept if we can understand the people we have hurt and get them on our side to see that we are caring about them, and that that might make a better difference for the public to realize the registry isn't the right way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been doing a lot of podcasts lately, and I've been listening to Amplified Voices a lot, and what's the other one? The one with Alyssa Ackerman. That's why I thought Ackerman. Alyssa
Oh,
Ackerman and
not me.
what's the name of that one? Beyond Fear. Anyway,
Ooh.
both of those podcasts talk a lot about restorative justice, and they talk a lot about how the whole criminal justice system like intentionally doesn't give the victims the thing that they are looking for, which is like acknowledgement of the pain that they caused and, you know, words of apology that, you know, when you're in the criminal justice system, you know, your lawyer's like, no, you can't say any of those words. And those are the exact words that the person who was harmed wants to hear.
The most needed words, yes.
Most needed words. All right, that seems like two pages full. I say we go. What do you think? Does that sound reasonable?
Thank you.
All right, so Trevor, I met Trevor at the NARSL conference in Houston in June and loved his talk. And then I also noticed that he was the author of this book that I had been devouring. So I reached out to him and he said, yeah, he would be happy to come and talk to us. He's got a couple of really great books and I'm going to let him take it away.
I always feel coming to these kinds of events like, I mean, y'all obviously have a different kind of expertise than I do and are your own experts on these issues in ways that I cannot, of course, imagine. I am not directly impacted by the registry. And I have come to this research through kind of a circuitous event of being a gay man, learning about sort of laws related to sexuality, and then learning about laws related to HIV. And in some states, those require registration. And that sort of led me to the registry. And so I've been working on issues related to the registry for maybe 6 or 7 years now, working on sort of just basic research on trying to explain kind of who's being impacted by the registry and to kind of raise attention to other social scientists. Because as I think you probably all have a sense, like these laws impact, you know, close to 1 million people on the registry in the United States. And yet very few people are aware of the issues with these laws, or really even the substance of them or why we have them, or if they're effective, which as we all know, they're not. And yet we spend a whole lot of money sort of investing in this apparatus. So I think it's just sort of an issue that deserves attention on so many different levels, political, sociological, from a social science perspective, but also from an advocacy perspective. So I sometimes straddle those worlds, mostly as a researcher, but also, you know, I sort of put on a hat that is kind of like an advocate at times while making sure that I always stay true to, you know, sort of whatever the evidence or research says. You know, we put out that book, The War on Sex, in 2017, because my co-author and I were looking out in the world and we saw this kind of narrative, which is like basically that, you know, from an LGBT perspective, we got same-sex marriage. And so, okay, everything must be fine now. And yet at the same time, all these laws had been cropping up that were basically cracking down on sexuality in this really onerous way, really harsh, really deeply punitive way. So it's like on one hand, like, you know, there's narrative progress, and on the real, like on the ground, like it's just like actually sexuality is more criminalized than ever. It just looks differently than most of us in the LGBT space had been kind of thinking of, you know, even as sodomy laws might have been quote unquote overturned by Lawrence versus Texas. You can still have police sting operations here in North Carolina in public parks for, you know, people arresting mostly gay men and mostly female sex workers. And those are the same people who were being arrested under sodomy laws before Lawrence versus Texas, the Supreme Court case that allegedly overturned these laws. So it's like kind of obvious, I think, once you start looking at it, that the progress is somewhat illusory. It's like an illusion, right? It's like it in fact doesn't have a lot of substance or depth in the way that, you know, I think a lot of us thought it did. And so I'm just sort of trying through my research and advocacy to kind of raise the, you know, profile of that fact. And that's what the war on sex was really trying to do, is just to say, hey, you know, remember the war on drugs, remember how well that went or is going? Not so well, right? We have not done anything to reduce the number of people who use drugs, even though we've sent lots of people to prison for doing it. And here, similarly with sexuality, we've, in the name of protecting children, we have put all sorts of people under really harsh forms of surveillance, lock them in prison for a very long time, and sexual victimization rates have not gone down. So we're not safer as a result of this effort. And there's some evidence that we're actually less safe than we were, because you're basically turning a whole class of people into second class citizens. And what happens when you are kicked out of society? You know, basically you can't have a job, you can't have a place to live, you can't have public benefits like food stamps. You know, all these sorts of penalties operate in similar ways that like a felony record does. It's just even more intense and harsh. And so we tend to be making problems worse, in my view, through these systems. And I'll tell you that one of the things that I think about a lot is when I presented some of my research, and someone from one of the federal agencies that works on the registry, or does work related to the registry, you know, he said, well, I know that, you know, the research says that these laws don't work, right? But I have a daughter, and I just feel safer for her knowing that they exist. And I feel like that captures, it was a moment of great honesty. I appreciated his honesty because it's so real, right? It's like, he's like basically saying, I get it, this doesn't work, but I feel better thinking in this, you know, imagining I live in a world where it does make us safer. So I think that's hopefully part of what I think some of us are trying to do in the research world, is to just show how it's, these laws are not doing what we think they are. Mostly they're making people's lives really miserable without doing much public benefit. I'm happy to like go in whatever directions people want to go with conversations or talk about. I've been working on civil commitment lately. That's how I sort of came to this conversation, is by presenting on that work at NARSOL the last 2 years. So we can talk about civil commitment. We can talk about issues related to the registry. What does research say? If people, you know, have questions about that, or I'm open to kind of going wherever people feel they wish to go. I don't want to kind of hog the microphone, because like I said, you know, everyone on this call is experts in their own way, and I'm certainly not
right.
Not the only one.
I don't know how many people actually read it, but they were supposed to. Encouraged to read the chapter 8, the Manzanares, Laura Manzanares chapter of War on Sex. So, you know, I certainly did my homework. So talking about anything in that book is great. And then I saw you have another newer book. And I know civil commitment has been definitely in the news a lot, in our news. Mm-hmm. So I know we have a lot of people interested in that topic as well. I don't really care which direction you go, because I'm sure it's all going to be fascinating.
I love Laura's chapter. I think it is just so clear and concise, and it's everything that academics often aren't. And so I really appreciate it, because Laura is not an academic. So she writes as a journalist. And I just think it's really a great for what they might do. It's this so eloquently said, which is basically that we're, you know, kind of erected this system of preventative detention, you know, that we're detaining people not based on past crimes, but future acts that we think they might do. And that kind of violates all these closely held constitutional protections that we have in the United States, that, you know, we're not supposed to do that kind of stuff. And yet, like for a lot of things related to people convicted of sexual offenses, we carve out these exceptions to say, well, in this case, we're going to violate this long-held tradition, you know, this closely held constitutional ideal for this group of people, because we really don't like them. You know, that's kind of her basic argument. And I think it's just well put. So I really do love that essay. That's why I had, you know, I told Anne that was, I think, the best one to assign, because it just really doesn't mince words and gets right to the point. And in the years since, you know, civil commitment has not changed much. So it still holds up. You know, it's not like it's outdated or anything. The issues remain the same.
Yeah, that was one of the most like disconcerting parts of that chapter for me. It was like all the times that you know, it's been tested in court, and the courts just say, oh, yeah, it's fine, like repeatedly. The willingness of Lady Justice to just like cover her eyes and pretend she doesn't see it is really just, it's shocking in a country where we pride ourselves on all these, you know, great freedoms and this great constitution that we've just chosen to ignore in so many different ways when it comes to this population. You know, we ignore it when police are doing stings. You know, we ignore it when police, you know, get to look at your computer without a warrant and they get to put stuff on your computer. And, you know, Bonnie, whatever her last name is, has tested that in court and brought it up in front of judges and said, like, it's illegal what they're doing. And they're like, well, yeah, but they're catching bad guys, so that's okay.
It really, I think, is always good to remember that, like, courts will not protect us unless there is a massive social movement also accompanying it that, like, demands it to be the case. Courts don't generally go out of their way to be like, oh, yeah, let's worry about this issue. If they can sidestep it, they will. And
especially when we are having elected judges who are being, you know, basically they have to taunt their tough on crime cred to stay in power or to stay on the bench. We're basically encouraging them to, you know, be tough on people, and it doesn't make anybody safer.
Exactly. I'm trying to read through the comments, and I see Eric's, I'm not sure which, saying my son has been in Coalinga State for the past 6 years. The psychologists don't care about the patients. They're pretty much told to keep everyone there. It's a big cash cow for so many companies and unions. And there often is this like financial interest at play, in part because the forensic psychiatrists involved make $5,000 to $10,000 per evaluation. And many of them make their careers in part on these evaluations. And mainstream psychiatry has said they don't want anything to do with it. They really oppose civil commitment. And so forensic psychiatry has kind of emerged to fill that void. There's a book, if people are interested in this, it's very academic. So, you know, it might be snoozeville for some, but there's some good stuff in it, which is called Sorting Sexualities. Stefan Vogler, he writes a lot about how kind of forensic psychiatry kind of emerged because mainstream psychiatry was basically like, this is messed up. Like, we shouldn't be doing this. This is a misuse of the ideals of civil commitment, and you're kind of undermining it by using it to achieve, you know, to use medical language to achieve punitive means, basically, is what they say. And that's kind of what it is. It's like they say it's not punishment, that it's treatment, but I'm sure as Arax knows, the amount of treatment in there is questionable in many of these facilities.
Yeah, I can't remember whether it was your talk or someone else's talk about civil commitment, but we actually got to speak on the phone. Was that your talk?
That's right.
We got to speak on the phone to a guy who was in civil commitment at the moment, and he compared the amount of treatment he got in the civil commitment facility compared to in the general population, and it was like not even close. Like in general population, he was getting, you know, a certain number of hours a day, and when he got moved to this other thing, it was like 4 hours a week or 4 hours a month. It was just pathetic. The idea that this is treatment. Well, if it's treatment, how come you're getting almost no treatment?
Exactly. Yeah, that's Daniel. He's in Moose Lake facility in Minnesota, and Minnesota is one of the most really, oh gosh, it's like a gulag. I mean, you really don't get out. I mean, some states let people out sometimes, not often, but like some people do end up getting out. Minnesota is one of those ones that's like, you almost never get out. I mean, no, almost really nobody gets out. There's been maybe three or four in 25 years. Many more people have died there in that time than have been released from that facility. And that's true. Is it David Davis asked, could you better define forensic psychiatry? It's sort of outside my, you know, that Stefan has written a lot about this. And from my perspective, it's just another subfield of psychiatry that agrees to work with criminal cases and particularly has agreed to screen these potential civil commitment detainees. Sometimes they're one-offs, but in a number of cases, the state contracts with the same kind of evaluators on a regular basis. So there are at least a chunk of their career is just evaluating potential civil commitment detainees. And that, of course, raises ethical questions. If you're, you know, if the person paying the bills is the state and they're seeking to detain someone, right, what does that do to your independence to come to a conclusion about whether this person, you know, really meets the criteria for being detained?
Right, exactly. Because if you're the kind of forensic psychologist who's going to say no a bunch of times, they're probably going to quit calling you.
They're going to call somebody else. And the defense knows this too. And so, like, you know, defense attorneys have other people that they work with on a regular basis. So it cuts both ways, of course. But nonetheless, it just, it kind of is this weird bastardization of notions of medicine for in the service of punishment, even though the state says it's not. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't buy that. I don't think we have to buy that. Of course, it's very punitive. And they say it's a hospital, but it's a prison. I mean, it looks like a prison. You know, if it walks like a dog, talks like a dog, it is a prison. So in that sense, it's, yeah, exactly. So Davis mentions the debunked experts. Forensic psychiatry is a mess and has come under a lot of withering scrutiny. Forensic science in general, not just psychiatry, for some of their supposed, you know, that kind of CSI stuff that looks really sexy and cool on television. And then over time, we learn that it's not as actually compelling as it, you know, was made out to be. So psychiatry is one sliver of that. And there's this larger field of forensics that has come under some scrutiny in recent years for various kinds of tests that are questionable. Yeah, IRX notes that the defense attorneys are really expensive. And that's, you know, so most people will get effectively a public defender, even though these are not criminal trials. The states usually make an attorney available, but of course they're public state employees. And so if you've ever had a public defender, or you know someone who has had a public defender, or your loved one has had a public defender, you know that they spend almost no time on these cases. And if you want a real attorney, if you want a private attorney, you know, we're talking 10,000 plus. And it's even complicated in these cases because they drag on for years. So it's not really like a criminal case. I mean, I don't even know what Eric's, you may know better than I do what a retainer would look like for a private attorney. It's got to be gobs of money because these cases just don't end. 300, I can't even look at that number because that is but I believe it because, you know, these cases always go to trial. So it's not like a criminal case where they typically plea out. Why would you plea out? You're going to be there forever, right? Like it's not something that people plea. Usually there are rare cases where people voluntarily self-commit, but it's not typical. So they all almost go to trial, and they go to trial again and again and again and again because you're there indefinitely. $140,000, June Chaplin says, and that is mind-numbing to hear. But again, it
June, sounds... did you win? Did you? Oh, and no, probably not, because I think you said your son is in civil commitment right now, right? Wow.
That's a lot of money. That's a house.
Yeah.
That's, I'm sure people.
And Trevor, is it really like, are they really using, talk a little bit about the static 99. And I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about that, because when I read over this static 99 instrument, I was like, it's like, how could that be enough to say someone is dangerous?
It's never enough, but it is part of the sort of what states use, the kind of apparatus. So to explain, a static 99 is this 10 question, they call it an instrument. It's basically like a survey that they ask about the people who are potentially going to be looked at for civil commitment. It's just 10 questions, and they all have binary answers, or like defined answers. I'll pull up, you know, so I can give you some examples of what these questions are. So the first question is the age of the person potentially being detained. And the older you are, your score goes down.
Just youth by itself gives you points.
That's right. So if you're 18 to 35, you get 1 point. And the second one is one of those questions that a lot of people have trouble with, because it is only men who are being asked these questions. And so there's a number of questions that suggest it could be potentially work against gay men. So the last question is, do you have any male victims in your criminal history? And if yes, the answer is yes, then you get a point. The second question I was talking about earlier is similarly questionable, because it asked if you've ever lived with a lover for at least 2 years. And if you say no, you get a point. And of course, if you're like, imagine if you're an 18-year-old gay boy living in, you can think of lots of scenarios where, it is very difficult to imagine that you would be able to answer yes to that. If you have any non-violent offenses, non-contact offenses, that adds a point. So there are all these variables, and the state, adds up all these numbers, and the score at the end places you in a category of either low to moderate high to high risk. And the higher your score, the more likely you are to be petitioned for commitment. And so we found that gay men, or I should say men with same-sex crime victims in New York and Tennessee and Texas were made up far more of the population of civil commitment than you would expect, given the proportion of people on the registry who had same-sex crime victims, about 10% on the registry versus about 1 in 3 in civil commitment. So it seems like there's some kind of bias that's going on that's disproportionately impacting, we could say gay men, at least people with same sex, people who have sex with people of the same sex, whether they identify as gay or not. So that's some of the research that I've tried to do is to look at what are the, we see the effects, which is this disproportionate impact, and Static 99 could plausibly be one of the instruments that's leading to this. Yeah, Davis, thank you for asking that question. Who developed this instrument, the Static 99? It was developed by researchers in Canada, and there's been two forms of it over time, the Static 99 and the Static 99R revised. They kind of do what sociologists, at least like I was taught in school, to never do, which is you just get a big data set and you let the statistic program figure out associations for you without any theory behind it. So all these are just things that are variables that are associated with an increased risk of recidivism over time. And so they would say, well, it's not that we're homophobic. It's just, it happens to be that people with same-sex crime victims, men with same-sex crime victims have higher rates of recidivism. We don't know why that is. They don't care why that is, right? They don't have any theory behind it. It's just based on these associations that are observed that they don't understand. And they actually don't really want or care to understand. And that's, again, like I said, in grad school, like my stats professor was like, don't ever do this, because if you don't have a theory, what are you really observing? You could find associations with the first letter of your name in a large enough data set. That doesn't mean it's a real thing that's observed in the world that you want to care about. Given a large enough data set, all sorts of stuff is going to be associated with all sorts of other stuff. And
especially if, already they're not being fair with, we already know that they tend to prosecute LGBT people more, and they're more likely to be on the registry in the first place. So saying, oh, we looked at the registry and figured out that you're at higher risk if you're, victims or whatever are the same gender. Well, you're picking from a pool that's already been tainted by bad implementation.
Yeah, totally. It kind of is just like a ball that rolls over time and collects more and more junk.
And nobody else. I just looked at this instrument one time for 5 minutes and thought, this can't be right. How is it that this, it's just gotten away with being the law of the land for so long?
I think as we kind of know, I think we probably, lots of people who learn more about the registry, you learn more about the criminal justice system all the time. And you're like, what? How is this happening? And it's just because people don't care, right? People don't care, and everybody sort of gets, the system just keeps, it's an albatross that just keeps on going. And I think it takes a concerted social movement to demand change, because the system isn't going to just decide one day like, oh, you're right, we're wrong. We're going to just voluntarily change this thing. So the Static 99, I will say they responded a little bit and created a revised version that is a tiny bit different, but it's just a tiny, it's barely different. You know, it really is the same.
I see Massachusetts Mike has his hand up. You ready for a quick question, Trevor?
All right, hey, how you guys doing?
Hey.
Hey, Trevor, got a question for you. This SVP commitment, civil commitment, rules, regulations, et cetera. It seems like that sort of procedure, that process or that hearing or whatever you might call it within a state would happen to an individual when they're incarcerated or, you know, going through the judicial process, possibly before they're coming off of probation, et cetera, et cetera. Can this process happen, in your experience, like decades after the fact?
So that's a great question, Mike. And in almost every state, you must be incarcerated at the time that the state petitions you. If you get out, they can no longer petition you for commitment. That's not true, I think, in Minnesota. But Minnesota is just like weird thing that everything I say is going to be like, well, not Minnesota. Minnesota does not require a sex offense conviction, for example. You can have a charge that was never convicted and that could still, but every other state requires a conviction, to my knowledge. Similarly, every other state requires you to be incarcerated. That could be jail, that could be prison. It can also be juvenile detention. So for example, in Florida, I can see in the records, there's this person who has been in the facility in Florida since 1999. And he came right out of juvenile detention because it was juvie. It's all sealed. And so I can't see anything about that case, but, so it does happen that they come straight from juvenile detention to the facility.
So let's hypothetically speaking, say that you have like a juvenile and he did something or she did something, say 20 years ago. Well, maybe not, obviously it would have to be after the Adam Walsh Act was created or implemented. So maybe 15 years ago now, if you will, or coming up on 15 years, whatever. We just use 15 years as a benchmark. And they decide they're in Florida. They were never civilly committed, et cetera, et cetera. And then they decide to move to Minnesota. And Minnesota's law says, hey, if you ever were found guilty or pled out to something, we're gonna civilly commit you now, 15 years after the fact.
Let me tell you about a case. There's a couple cases like this in Florida that speak to that point, which is people who had out-of-state sex offenses from, let's say, the 90s, maybe even the 80s or 70s. They were old convictions. As you may know, within 48 hours of stepping in the state of Florida, you must notify the police that you are there. Otherwise, you are failing to register, and that's a felony in Florida. There are several cases where, let's say that you had a conviction with the 80s, you've been out of prison for a long time. You go to Florida, you get arrested for failure to register. You are put in prison for 3 years. There are several cases where at that point they are civilly committed, even though it had been 30 years, I think, in these cases since their last offense. And they had been out, you know, for a long time. Many of these people go straight from one facility to another, but there are cases like that where they had been out in the world without a conviction. And then it's the failure to register that is the offense that gets them. I don't want to say that that's typical because it's not. It's atypical, but at least it illustrates those are the cases that seems most kind of like, wow, you really are going out of your way to really make this person's life miserable.
So not to cut you off.
Yeah, no, please. Yeah,
not to cut you off. I am a product of a case exactly like that. And I won't obviously get into the details, but it's funny that you went in this direction of the static 99 and static 202R and static stable 2007. Because in my process of what I've went through, I had learned that the leveling board was ultimately the board that was doing those statistical psychological evaluations. I didn't know that civil commitment boards, if you will, or maybe they work hand in hand. I'm not sure if those are two separate entities. But in my situation, I was actually never, they never gave me a rating for the static 99R or the 202R or the stable 2007. And they still yielded their decision of what they did, as far as the leveling board goes. So in my perspective and what my experience is that leveling boards, maybe even civil commitment boards, just because the state law says they have to use those psychological instruments, I'm a product that they didn't. They deviated from that completely, and they never even used any of that information and still yielded the decision. I don't necessarily know with your experience if those particular entities in place are allowed to do that or not.
That's a great question. So leveling boards, I just focus on the civil commitment, you know, kind of boards. And in Florida, those are separate entities. They may be similar or related in other states. I'm not sure, but in Florida, they're not, to my knowledge. And they have changed it recently where you don't have to use these instruments, but they often still do. To my knowledge, I don't know that it was ever a requirement or just whether it was practice. That's a good question.
I know in this particular state that I'm dealing with, it's in their state general law. It literally says that under their sex offender community notification guideline systems by the governor, they have to implement this scientific procedures, if you will, in order to come up with a determination of 1 through 3, et cetera, et cetera.
Go ahead.
So I didn't mean to cut you off, but I want to finish up my sort of segment here before so someone else can get on. But I just wanted to hear your thoughts as far as like, you know, the civil commitment and that those sort of procedures, if you will, and then how they relate to, you know, I kind of breezed through your chapter and it was actually touching base on the Constitution, Fourth Amendment, right to, you know, feel secure in their persons against unreasonable searches and seizures and et cetera. And it's almost like this is the loophole, you know, where, you know, hey, we don't care that you did something 30 years ago. We don't care that you did something 15 years ago. We don't care if you're traveling from one side of the country to the other. We can violate the Fourth Amendment and this is our loophole. You know, we're locking you up and that's that.
Yeah, there's a great article by, Corey Young. It's about the war on sex offenders, the emerging criminal war on sex offenders, the title of the article. And he kind of goes through this exercise of being like, how do we know something is a war? And one of the things that he says is that is typical of these, you know, kind of artificially defined wars from governments is that we tend to carve out all these exceptions to closely held constitutional protections, to laws, et cetera. And so he does this comparison between the war on drugs and the war on, he says the war on sex offenders. And I find that helpful, but it speaks to this issue you're talking about, which is, you know, we just sort of bulldoze over some of these protections that we thought were pretty ironclad, right? And then suddenly they just disappear. Like you said, Fourth Amendment protection, ex post facto laws. You know, these many people are impacted by these laws, even as they were passed after their underlying offenses. And that shouldn't usually be the case. But again, because they say it's not punishment, it's fine. The registry is administrative. It's not punitive. And, you know, we know that that's all garbage, but that's how the state gets away with it. Is this exceptionalism. And I wish I could say that there's some secret formula where you could shake someone the right way and they'd be like, oh yeah, I see that now. And it just seems like, as you know, so many people have tried that in court with civil commitment, but also with all of the registry related laws. And typically the answer, you know, is that it doesn't matter. And that's, I can imagine, especially when you are directly impacted, that is not just disheartening, it is crushing, soul crushing.
Oh, it's traumatizing. I see, yeah. Trauma therapy still to this day from my experience.
I can imagine. Well,
I just want to formally thank you for all your service that you've been putting into this, and you know, especially everyone else that's putting in their time and burning the midnight oil to get to the bottom of something, you know.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that because I think you know, I think really how I think about it for myself is I think about all the things in my life as a gay man who came out of the 90s when gay sex was a felony in North Carolina, there is really 17, maybe not, I won't put a number on it, but there are a lot of different encounters that could have landed me on the registry as someone who was in a criminalized position at from a young age. And so I just think, I'm grateful, obviously, that that didn't happen, but I don't really see a big difference between, you know, some of the things that I did. And I try to always remind myself that I could be on this, you know, there's a lot of timelines where I am.
Well,
I'm the same way. I could be on it. My daughter could be on it. You know,
John Walsh himself has admitted he would have been on it.
Yeah.
Oof. That's one of the ironic things. He when he met his wife, she was underage, and he created the Adam Walsh Act in memory of his son. So it's weird, it's ironic. But all right, well, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much, and I'm gonna go silent, but I'm gonna keep listening.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks.
Yeah, honestly, the number of I think that eventually that's gonna be their downfall is that they're gonna try they're getting greedy and they're trying to spread their net too far, and now. You know, it used to be that they just sucked up little bits of people, right? Gay people and poor people and people of color. And it seems like lately they've just gotten so brazen about it that they're sweeping up. I heard a stat. Do you have any better numbers than this? I've heard between 25 and 33% of people on the registry are on it for something they did when they were a teenager.
Mm.
Do you know any way to, have you ever gotten a good number on that?
I've heard different figures. I don't have a number myself. I think that would be like an Alyssa Ackerman kind of question. I'm sure she would know, or Jill Levinson, for example.
Well, of course, they make it impossible to really know because they, you know, if you're a juvenile, they don't have to publish the statistics.
It's really hard to get reliable information in so many ways. And so even the number of people on the registry is kind of difficult because, of course, there are a lot of people on the registry who are double counted in multiple states. And people who've been deported, people who are deceased. So, you know, it might be 850,000 people who are on the registry, but, you know, actually what is the real number of people without double counting, et cetera, is hard to know. I think it's all sort of like, you know, moving small bits of things around. I think we have enough to say that this is a system gone horribly wrong and is, you know, we don't necessarily need more data to reach that conclusion. I think it's pretty clear. So there are all these debates that I think academics sometimes get into, which are sort of like, okay, I get it. But I think what we do know is enough to say, wow, this is really messed up and is not serving our needs as a society. And is actually maybe shooting ourselves in the foot for sure. And like I said, what I said earlier, I really think a concerted social movement is the only thing that will change the game. And I look at the war on drugs. To me, that is really the case. And it seems like maybe it wasn't as bad. But if you go back to the 90s and look and listen to a lawmaker talk about crack cocaine in urban areas and the way they talked about particularly Black men, as even Hillary Clinton, super predator, right? She uses the word super predator. That looks an awful lot like some of the discourse right now around these laws, around the registry. And it took 30 plus years to kind of move the needle, you know, to say, okay, maybe we shouldn't just punish the crap out of people who use drugs. Maybe it's not working for us. And so, you know, I think it took a massive kind of social dialogue and a reckoning over multiple decades to kind of just put, not even to roll back the system, as you know, with drugs, but just to at least stop it from expanding and maybe rolling back a little bit. And that's what I think it'll probably take here is, you know, it's not something that's going to be tomorrow. It's going to be, I'll be gray haired probably and still talking about this stuff.
Yeah. And the problem is that they, you know, they terrified us in the sex panics of the 80s with all the, you know, anal rape in daycares.
Right.
And the children on the milk cartons and
satanic rituals.
They terrified us on purpose, you know, to get themselves elected, right? To make us scared so that they could campaign of being tough on crime. And now everybody's scared. And we actually do run into politicians who admit to us yeah, you know, they understand that it's not working, that it's a waste of money and so on. But now they don't know how to put the genie back in the bottle because everybody's so terrified. You know, I had a conversation, unrelated conversation with somebody the other day about hell. And, you know, did she believe in hell? And I said, I don't really believe in hell. And she's like, yeah, the only people that should go to hell are murderers and child molesters.
Yep.
You know, so, you know, we've terrified the population to the point where even when we realize this is a giant waste of money and really we're just enriching the for-profit prisons and so on, the politicians can't really put it, they can't really put the genie back in the bottle without, you know, I think what needs to happen is we, as a population, we, you know, affected by this registry, we have to come out of the shadows. We have to start networking with each other and talking to more people. You know, not a day goes by I don't have three or four conversations about this with random strangers everywhere. We all need to start doing that and letting people know how dangerous the system is to us. You know, that it's not, we shouldn't be afraid of the people on the registry. We should be afraid of the registry because they're sweeping up, you know, now they're sweeping up, you know, 20-year-old white college kids and, you know, teenagers that are sexting and, you know, they're getting really brazen about it. And, you know, people need to understand they're the ones at risk, right? People who are not on the registry are much more likely to get put on the registry than you're a lot more likely to get swept up into the registry or have someone, you know, get swept up into the registry than you ever are to be harmed by someone on the registry. And the sooner we figure that out, the better.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like partially there's just this fundamental misunderstanding about how most sexual violence occurs in the United States. Of course, there is a pervasive pattern of sexual violence and harm that we should be investing in preventing, responding to, managing. Most, you know, cases of victimization are the result of someone who is your, it's usually women victims and it's usually male perpetrators and it's usually an uncle, a brother, a boyfriend, someone that they intimately knew. And the whole premise of the registry is based on stranger danger. It's based on this idea that you can protect yourself or your family from someone living three doors down who you didn't know, will never know, will probably never interact with. And that's just not, and of course it hasn't, then the registry hasn't reduced sexual victimization because it just isn't designed to do that, right? It's designed to prevent these really pretty rare offenses, like, you know, the cases that they're named after, the Adam Walsh Act, the Jacob Wetterling Act, Megan Kenka for Megan's Law. These were heinous crimes, of course, all of them, and deserve social response, but they are atypical. Not just atypical, they're really not representative of any way. And yet we designed this whole legal system around them. And so we're just making a lot of people's lives really hard without actually benefiting. And again, I just want to highlight, it's not just benefiting, it's that it actually be making us less safe by increasing inequality, by making people's lives unlivable. And so when you make people's lives unlivable, you know, bad things happen. It just is not conducive to a functional society.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of things we got to do. We've got to come out of the shadows. You know, when you think about the dramatic change for LGBTQ issues, you know, just in the pretty recent past, it swung a really long way in a very short period of time. And I think that's because people who were LGBTQ stopped hiding and they just kind of got momentum and people started standing up and saying, yep, me too, me too, me too. And pretty soon, you know, if you wanted to be a homophobe, you looked around, there's a lot of people that you knew well that you were going to have to hate. So it's a lot harder to hate your granddaughter, your uncle, you know, your cousin, your teacher, than it is to hate some idea that you have of what a gay man is. Right. If the only idea in your head is, you know, that guy wearing the chaps and the gay pride parade, that's maybe scary for you. When it's, you know, people all around you that you know really well, it's a lot less scary and it's harder to hate them. And I think that we, you know, we've been terrified by, you know, vigilante violence, by just public opinion, by by a lot of things. We've been terrified, and most people on the, a lot of people in the registry, just they don't go anywhere. They don't go outside the boundaries of their own tiny universe because it's just so scary. And I think part of our solution has got to be, you know, starting, as terrifying as it is, we've got to start talking to the people around us and letting them realize that that idea they have in their head of that, you know, terrible, creepy, whatever, that's not what we really are. You know, there's a million of us, right? And the cost, the collateral consequences to the people on the registry, to their families, to their children, are really outrageous. Wow, I'm way behind. There's so many words.
There's a great chat. Yeah, y'all have a really vibrant group, which is awesome. Sees everybody so engaged.
Yeah, every time I start to type a comment, there's like 17 more comments down below it that I got to go read. So Trevor, you're going to help me keep up to find out who's the next person. Nobody has their hand up, but
No hands up right now. Yeah, yeah. If anyone wants to raise your hand, this would be a great time if you want to chime in.
We got to be more visible, and we got to have these hard conversations with people all over. You know, we got to start. I would love to, and I sometimes envision myself doing this. I once did in Wichita, Kansas, where my partner lives now. I once did literally counted every single person on the registry just so that I'd have a number. I would love someday to somehow pick a representative sample, if there's a way to do that, and like go through and actually write down, you know, what percentage of people are on for, you know, this crime versus that crime versus this other crime. You know, I wish there was a way to get good statistics on that, because I think people imagine that the registry is all, you know, guys who, you know, stay across the street from a park, and I don't know, you know, we all know what people think, but really it's not that at all. And I think if people could really see like a pie chart for, you know, this chunk of it is all child porn. And you know who controls the child porn? The cops. The cops say out loud, they control all the child porn in the United States, and they distribute it, they maintain it, they put it out there to trap people. Well, that's not really actual, it's not actually, they're not saving us from a danger. They're passing out matches and saying that they're saving us from arsonists.
Yeah. Abbasi, it looks like Abbasi has their hand raised.
Oh, hit us, Abbasi.
Okay. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Yeah. Since we got you on the show, something just popped into my mind. You know what will spark a movement, in my opinion? I think those of us like myself that's actually on the registry, we can't be out front so much. But the families of the and the friends and like war, women against, like they have to be the face of it, because they didn't actually do anything. And remember in the 80s when AIDS, Remember in the 80s when AIDS started to pick up and it was such a scary thing. If you catch it within 6 months, you die, and people didn't know how you catch AIDS. They didn't want people with AIDS breathing on them or nothing like that. And then what broke the fever is when Elizabeth Taylor, people like her that came out, and she embraced openly, no, you can't catch AIDS that way. And she started to openly embrace the people with AIDS. We need people that are not on the registry to openly embrace. Now, this is my cousin. I don't care what you say. This is my cousin. This is my father. This is my son, or whatever, like that. They have to be fighting for it. You say you're going to prosecute me for harboring a sex offender? F you, bring it on. I'm not going to enforce this garbage on my son, my own flesh and blood. It has to be like that. They have to be the face. Like, I'm convicted of a crime, so maybe I wouldn't be the face, but they have to be leading that public. So like Ann said, you know, have to talk about it more. We have to talk about it more behind the scenes, but as far as like up front, the family and the friends.
Yeah, up front, I completely agree. But I think everybody needs to be talking to their circles and widening their circles and finding people that you know already love you or already accept you and already aren't terrified of you, and start to make small progress. I've started thinking about... Mm-hmm.
One more thing. Nicki Minaj's husband, as far as I know, is on the registry. Imagine her next concert. I'm not saying she would do this. If she were to say, listen, y'all are my fans, but this is my husband. Come on up on stage, honey. I love this man. I hear a lot of y'all talking. the reason why I support him, blah, 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 blah. And she talk about good things he does. And that would kind of like break the fever to not all over the country, but to a large extent when people like that, that's personally affected. I don't think she would do that, but you see what I'm saying?
You know what? You never know. It maybe I try to get Nicki Minaj on the war room.
That oh, is look, somebody says she has. Somebody needs.
I wrote it down.
Yeah, she says she has. Okay, thank you. I'm gonna stop talking so somebody else can talk.
Thank you.
All right.
I think that's a great point, Abbasi. But I think, you know, like Ann said, I think everyone has a role to play. People directly impacted obviously have to protect their own selves and, you know, worry, make sure that you are safe and you are getting what you need. And that may preclude you from being open and playing that role. Some people may be in a position to make that decision to be open about their registry experience, or, you know, they may have no choice, right? Because, you know, they may not voluntarily come out of the shadows. People may thrust them into the limelight.
Yeah, well, that's what happened to my partner. He got doxxed by just some idiot who, you know, posted something on Facebook and said, oh, this kid, you know, I caught him selling bikes to kids, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, my partner was in this difficult situation where we were like, we knew this was out there and we had a choice to either like kind of leave that scene and try to go somewhere else or just like try to own it. So he, you know, I have this group of people that rides bikes, you know, on Fridays, you know, about probably 30 people. And one day he just stood up in that crowd and said, hey, you guys, you know, something's been going around about me. And, you know, I got a confession to make and, you know, I'm not proud of it. I don't ask you to excuse it. You know, I don't excuse it. It was, I'm sorry that I did it. It was a terrible thing, but, you know, it was a long time ago. I learned a lot about myself and I'm, you know, I'm not a danger to anybody. And, you know, I hope you can forgive me and let me continue to be in this space. And, you know, people were almost universally loving and supportive of him. And I tell you what, after that day, there was a real like palpable change in the way he just felt, because he no longer felt like, oh God, any minute they're going to, you know, find out that I'm on the registry and they're going to freak out. And, you know, because he's everybody already knows. And, you know, the few little dissenting voices who were a little crabby in the margins quickly got sort of like ignored. And then they just shut up when they realized, oh, they're not going to talk us all into, you know, a lynch mob. They had to just kind of drift into the shadows. And now, you know, we're on friendly terms with almost everybody. It feels great. It was really scary. I mean, he didn't sleep for days, but after he did it, he felt a lot better. And I'm not saying that it can never go wrong, because of course there are, you know, there are terrible vigilante, you know, people do awful things. So it takes a lot of courage. And I wouldn't recommend doing it, you know, just on the street corner. I would recommend you doing it with people that already kind of know and trust you. Okay, still another 20 things to catch up on now. Yeah, my Massachusetts Mike, divide and conquer. That's a great idea. Group of people. Yeah. Well, I've been starting to think about, like, I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but we have a map of every single person who's on the registry. I've started to think, like, maybe we write up a letter saying, you know, some things we were planning to do soon, and you know, each of us could just look on our little map of little red dots and go deliver some letters and try to raise our army that way. Ooh, Hi, Jim Zezzo.
Hi. I just feel people should not give up and pursuing going through the courts through this, of showing that it's unconstitutional or making a motion or something. You know, eventually some judge may see that, you know, through the motion and that it is unconstitutional and will affect a lot of us in a better way. For example, had a lawyer who showed that it was unconstitutional for a residency restriction. She had to go through an appeal, but she won that in New York. So this is possible. If somebody goes to court, shows it's unconstitutional, let's say I want my level lowered, And I want to show it's also unconstitutional. If there is a judge that would ever agree to that, that will affect many of us. And so it could be possible, if you don't give up, then go still through the court.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of litigation going on all the time. It's impossible to keep up, but I think, what is it, the Sex Offense Policy Network or a legal net? There's some. I get a newsletter from some organization that tracks all these lawsuits happening across the United States at any moment, because there are just, you know, and of course, absolutely, I think people need to use the law in whatever way that they can to try to, you know, resist, push back against this system. And all I'm saying is just, I think the law will not be the only tool. We have to use multiple, many tools, including social movement advocacy, including lobbying lawmakers. You know, courts will not be the only, can't be the only recourse.
I just want to say, if you did it as a group defendant, more than one person, as a group, I'd say there's even more power and numbers.
Yeah,
there is a large group thing going through the Missouri courts right now. But I agree with Trevor that I don't think it's going to just be, this isn't going to just be one in the legislative area. It's not going to just be one in the courts, because both the legislators and the courts are afraid of the population, the backlash that they would get. Because, you know, if, like I said before, you know, they convinced us all that this is the scariest thing on earth. And if they try to dial it back, you know, we have politicians who will say, yeah, we know, but they won't actually take it back because the population thinks it's terrifying. So we need to work on all fronts. But one of the fronts we need to work on is convincing the population that it's not, that we're not scary, that, and that, that, that the system is what we should be scared of, so that when the politicians start to make incremental changes to take the system down, they don't get voted out of office immediately. And that's a tall order. Jim Zezo, is this a new hand or an old hand? I'm guessing an old hand.
Yeah, I was just thinking. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Someone say something.
No.
Okay. I was just thinking on a different issue, for example, like same-sex marriage, which of course achieved this great constitutional Supreme Court case. It didn't come out of nowhere. And by the time they decided, like 60% of Americans supported same-sex marriage. And it's not, they didn't act ahead of that, right? They're acting behind it. They are trailing public opinion. Of course, the court now is a whole nother set of issues that is not aligned with public opinion in so many ways, right? But historically, right, the court doesn't really go out on a limb. You know, there are exceptions to that, of course, but I mean, just, you know, we shouldn't kid ourselves that thinking that they're going to side with on a big way with people on the registry when so many Americans do not understand the registry and don't care and really have a lot of obvious stigma, bias, prejudice, hatred, you know. So I think there's got to be a lot of work to undo all that stigma, bias, prejudice, hatred.
Yeah, and they've made it so that people on the registry are so, they're, you know, they can't find jobs, they can't find housing. I mean, they've handicapped our population so dramatically that we don't have the reason. I mean, we're barely managing our own lives, right? We're trying to constantly fight, you know, against tier changes, and we're fighting new residency restrictions, and we're trying to follow all the rules, and the rules change every 30 seconds, and you know, so we, the people on the registry, are not really in great shape to advocate for ourselves. Yeah, it's, I'm sure it's really nefarious. It's nefarious intent. And I think they know that they're not making the world safer. I think they're doing this, you know, because it's paying the bills. Ooh, a new hand, Nina.
Hi, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And you actually brought something up that I have been literally dreading, is the whole job situation, because not only do people, some companies hire misdemeanors while other people hire felons, but we're not, the people on the registry are not just felons. They are beyond just having a felony. They are literally, you can't be like, oh, these are felony friendly jobs. But when you go in and basically are in front of other people, you are literally denied pretty much every possible job, even if it's felony friendly. And it's crazy because that's something that I am truly dealing with right now. And being in the workforce in the society that we live now is just unbelievable. Thank you.
The other thing that I think is going to be part of our strategy moving forward is, you know, as it is now, there's actually quite a few efforts to, you know, reentry programs, trying to get people health care before they get out of prison and trying to restore the right to vote in certain places. And there's a lot of kind of understanding in the world that, shit, we're incarcerating so many of our population that we're kind of handicapping ourselves as a nation. And so there's a lot of efforts to, you know, kind of dial that back and make things easier for felons, but they're constantly cutting our population out. And so one of the tactics that we're starting to consider is showing up for other groups as they try to, you know, do certain things, you know, as they, you know, sitting with groups of people that are trying to cut us out, showing up for their meetings and helping them out on whatever it is that they're worried about. We just recently worked in Kentucky and Washington. They needed constituents to, it was a bill to get Medicaid for people before they got out of prison so that you'd have healthcare on your first day out. And it wasn't really for our population, it was for anybody in prison. But instead of not showing up for that advocacy and then letting them cut us out, we sat at the table with them and, you know, we helped them find, you know, I made like 40 calls in Kentucky and 50 calls in Washington or whatever to try to help them with that advocacy in the hopes that, you know, they'd see us sitting at the table and then they'd be less likely to throw us under the bus later. So we are looking, you know, Megan and I sit on different working groups to, you know, to end civil commitment in New York and things like that. In an attempt to just raise the visibility of our population and not wait till they cut us out and then complain about it, but show up before they cut us out and be a face in the room.
In the new book that I have called Unsafe Words, which is about queer people and consent and also about what happens when there's, you know, violations of consent, I interviewed a woman, a trans woman named Dominique Morgan, who's historically been a prison abolition advocate. And she talks about being on the other side of that, working in prison abolition spaces, and then someone showing up who was on the registry and her having to work through, especially as a victim of sexual violence, historically, kind of like moving past her preconceived notions about all the things that came with that idea. And learning to understand people in the registry, but also, you know, learning to include the registry as an issue of prison abolition in her advocacy. And it can have a profound impact as it did on her, because before that interaction, she would have said, oh, no, I don't want to deal with that issue. I don't want to talk to people in the registry. Those people are not the people I want to help. And then after that, just one interaction, really, it was just one interaction with a powerful advocate who really changed her worldview. And she talks about that in the interview in the book. And I think that that speaks to what you're saying, which is that, you know, it takes a colleague of mine, Mandy Carter, used to say justice or just us, that it requires, you can't just, you know, if you work just on your one little issue and don't reach out and work with other groups working on related issues, you know, your progress will be stymied. You've got to really build coalitions. And that's hard. It's hard work. But I think it can be powerfully effective when you're at the table instead of, as you say, being cut out.
Yeah. The Beyond Fear podcast does a lot of, you know, it's two victims of sexual violence who have come around to realizing, oh, wait, nothing is what I thought it was. And wow, None of the things that, you know, are happening to the people that I wanted to, you know, wanted to punish, none of that is making us safer. That's a really powerful podcast. A lot on there about restorative justice. All right. Once again, I'm way behind.
Any hands up? Sounds like it would be good for my students too.
Oh, it's so good. You know, they have a whole, they they just hit such a wide range of issues that, you know, it's just done very powerfully, because it's definitely, you know, they start it from a real victim's perspective. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the first season, they actually have an episode where they say, you know what, the registry is not doing what we think it's doing. And, you know, I know this seems insane that, you know, two victims, you know, the main Alyssa Ackerman, or not Alyssa Ackerman, I don't know why I can't think of her name, the not Alyssa Ackerman, she was, you know, raped at knife point at 16 or something like that, or 18. And here she is. She is thinks that the registry is a terrible idea.
Wow.
Anyway, we have a lot, just so you know, it's been a kind of a slow onboarding process for the new board. You know, we have a fairly young group of people here, and it's taken us a while to sort of like figure out all the things we're supposed to be doing and figure out what we want to be doing and how we're going to spend our time. But I really appreciate those of you who are sticking with us and cheering us on, because it's a big project. And, you know, I feel I'm pretty new to this. I've only been with my partner for 3 years, and I only found WAR about maybe a year and a half ago or so. So just learning all the cases and the podcasts and the, you know, I feel like I'm drinking from a fire hose most of the time.
You really have to become an expert. It's crazy. You know, you basically get a PhD in these issues.
Yeah,
you're impacted, or when someone you love is impacted. That's what I think is really important to remember. And that's what HIV advocates said. We talked about HIV advocacy earlier in the 80s around AIDS advocacy. You know, they really coined this idea that people impacted are experts and should not, you know, you don't have to defer to experts on this issue, because you have your own.
You are the experts.
Exactly. And I think owning that is really, can be really powerful.
Yeah. And honestly, I think HIV played into this a little bit, because, you know, when a lot of people who are parents today, or who were parents of the generation before that, when they were young, they had sex, you know, they had sex when they were not married, and nothing bad happened, and they didn't, nobody freaked out. But all of a sudden, now they've got kids growing up in the era of HIV, and like the idea that their kids are going to have sex is just so terrifying that people just freaked out. So between the sex panics in the 80s with the, you know, all the things we've previously mentioned, and HIV, you know, demonizing gay people, it made us crazy, and it made us do a bunch of crazy things.
Yeah, exactly. The introduction to the war on sex, that introduction chapter, we try to kind of make those connections really evident.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in reading more about that,
the war on sex is a fabulous. It's just, I mean, it's terrifying and makes me mad every minute, but it's so wide ranging, and it just really helps you understand where this came from and what it's there for. And I'm reading all the books.
Yeah, it's good. It's like I said, it's like you have to become your own little, you have to get a PhD basically. But once you have that expertise, no one can take it from you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anyway, we're really working hard, and I know it's really easy to lose hope when you are a victim of this system, because it's relentless, you know, just absolutely relentless, and they make it impossible for you to be, you know, they're changing the rules every minute so that because they want to get you in trouble for not following the rules, but the rules aren't actually doing anybody any good. The rules are just intentionally messing with this population, because they know if they keep us down and keep us terrified, we can't push back. We don't have any leftover emotional bandwidth to push back any harder, but we're working on it.
Amen.
And for those of you whose family members, you know, I'm blessed in that my most affected loved one is, you know, he's been out for more than a decade, and he's like got a good job again, and he's kind of back in a pretty good shape. So even though the registry is still a complete headache for us, it's nothing like, you know, I wasn't with him during all the hard parts, the you know, I have a big group of moms that I know in my town whose sons are all in jail right now. And I can't even imagine how overwhelming that would feel. So, you know, every day I just, I get phone calls and letters from just more and more just desperate people. I talked to a lady this afternoon who's 3 days from getting kicked out of her house, you know, because they sold her building and she can't find any place that she can afford. And just it's heartbreaking every minute of every day. Okay, I think we should pick a mainstream national reentry org to join and a local one.
Yeah.
Well, just let me just tell you that we are, I have a strategy meeting tomorrow with the consultant we've hired to kind of give us some tips. And this first 6 months that we're, that the new board is on is new. We're kind of using this first 6 months to sort of make a grand plan. So although it may not feel like we're doing anything right now, we're talking a lot and we're making a lot of, we're working really hard, and we'll have some things to unveil. We're going to start a newsletter again, Taylor Swift. Well, honestly, if anybody knows anybody remotely famous or knows anybody who knows anybody remotely famous, yeah, certainly having a big name like that could really make a big difference. And a lot of people are offering to help. They're offering, you know, I'm in prison, what can I do to help? Or I'm, you know, my son's in the registry, what can I do to help? We're not quite ready to like mobilize all these volunteers quite yet, but we're making a plan. And when we find that plan, you'll be the first to know. Fam, stupid fam. They really do cut us out. They cut us out a lot. And so I have not, honestly, if you're on fam's webs, you know, on their list and they're asking you for things, the best answer that I've gotten, somebody sent me the other day, a little blurb she sends them, which is, I can't support you because you cut out my population. When you realize that my population is part of your population, then we'll join you. So, you know, reaching out to the groups that are cutting us out, carving us out, and saying, I can't support you until you quit carving us out is a, I don't know, it's a possibility. Anyway, I promise we're working on it. All right, 24. We got 6 minutes. Anybody got a hand ready to raise?
I'm tired.
Abasi?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The UV4SOR was asking. That's exactly the message I was talking about, Amy, asking us to email fam and tell them, you know, because I think people need to realize that we are, there's a lot of us. We really need to start talking. All right, Abasi.
Okay. Hopefully we find one, because I was about to say something that people are going, if we can't find a national, when I say a national one, I don't mean each of us pick our own. I mean, we all say that's active, say, okay, it's 1,000 of us in war or whatever. Say, we're all going to join this, and then we definitely will have a voice in organization. But if we can't find one, we have to make another organization that includes not just people on the registry, but anybody can join. I hope we don't have to do that, because we barely can do this one, these ones here. So that, yeah. So if we can't, if everybody cuts, we got to have some self-respect. We can't treat, they can't treat us like the Democrats treat Black people. And I'm a Black person, so I can say that. So like they just, we just take you for granted. They got to be like, no, if we come with you, you have to address our issue. When a lawmaker say, no, we're going to do this, but not for those people. No, then we're not going to do anything, you know? So hopefully we don't have to make another organization and just have it where we're just going to include everybody. Hopefully we can find one that's already out there. And let's say you approach them, but you have 1,000 of us behind you. You say, listen, I represent 1,000 people or something or whatever.
And we're ready to come. And actually, one of our techniques is called, it's called astroturfing. And Megan, our new president, is she's very good at using astroturfing. And that means, you've heard the word grassroots, right? Grassroots means, you know, you're working with all the little people. Astroturfing is where you sort of pretend, you act like you've got more people than you really do. And that's something that Megan, that's one of the reasons that we picked Megan to be our president, because she's so good at that particular strategy. So we're not necessarily sharing all the things that we're doing behind the scenes very, very effectively yet. But I want you to know that we're working hard every day at all the things that we got to do to be more effective. Yeah, Elena advocates, that's right.
All right. Just let me know. I'll join.
We're working on it. And it won't be long. So, Trevor, I don't know. We got 3 minutes left. You got any closing thoughts for us? Any
words
for hope?
Oh gosh, hope is important. I know it's hard. It's really easy to get. And I'm not even as someone who's not directly impacted. It's like the more you learn, the more it's pretty challenging, depressing, frustrating, you know, maddening, all the words of negative emotions. And yet, you know, of course, if nothing happens, then it'll just stay the same. And I think that, you know, I don't want to live in a world where that's the case. So I think that change is slow and will not come overnight in most cases, but it doesn't mean we can't try. And so I think, you know, I appreciate everyone on the call saying that they, you know, want to do what they can, because I think that's most people really do want to do what they can. And it varies, right? Like different people can have different levels of engagement with this stuff. And some people can be more involved than others because of all sorts of issues like jobs, their families, their housing status. There's so many variables, of course, but for those that can, even just being here and being part of this conversation is contributing in some small way.
That and educate yourselves. Read all the, you know, read all the books, listen to all the podcasts, educate yourself so that you'll be a better advocate when it's time to start talking. Because, you know, step one is to build our army. Step two, I think, is to start working on causes with other groups that really should have our backs, but don't. You can start building your army and educating yourself now, right? Start making your little circle of people bigger and bigger and finding more and more people that know and love you and will help us when we're ready.
And if you ever need a copy of like an article or something, if you're reading, you know, because a lot of this academic stuff, in particular studies, can be behind paywalls, you know, feel free to just email me and ask me to, I'm happy to send you a copy if you encounter something like that. That happens pretty typically.
That's really generous.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate that. Yeah. Next
civil commitment articles on a regular basis.
Next 2 weeks from now, we're going to have Emily Horowitz talking about her new book, From Rage to Reason, which is a $60 book. You know, we can't all afford to buy, especially this population can't all afford to buy a $60 book. But I went to my library. My library has a little box at the bottom that says request a purchase. So I requested a purchase and I just got the notification today that they bought it and they've got my name on it. So
that's great.
That's a way to get around that.
Yeah. And if there's any chapter in The War on Sex you want a copy of, I'm happy to share chapters. I the whole book is a little tough to share, but a chapter or something, you know, feel free to reach out.
All right. Awesome. Well, we really appreciate your time. And I know you stayed up kind of late for us. How can they contact you, Trevor? Someone wants to know.
Oh, if you just Google my name, I'm like everywhere. You can find me on Twitter at Trevor Hoppe. You can find me at trevorhoppe.com. You can find me at my UNCG faculty profile. But I promise if you just Google my name, you'll find me some one way or another. I'm on the internet in a lot of different ways. Right. So I'm not hard to find.
All right. Well, we really appreciate your time. If you come up with anybody else that you think would be good candidates for me, for our Zoom, let me know. And thank you everybody who attended. We really appreciate all your time, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. If you haven't found a way to read From Rage to Reason, that's okay. Emily is fascinating whether you've read her books or not. So you guys will love that next 2 weeks from now. All right, love you guys. Good night.
Good night, all.